One of the things I did was I interviewed some faculty members. And I thought this person's reflections were particularly poignant and helpful to think about the situation. This is a woman, faculty member. She said, "When I hear people talk about how they make it, juggling all the demands in their lives, I hear them say things like, I say no to students a lot. I say don't call me at home. I say see me only during my office hours. I don't over-prepare for my classes. I now go in and I just teach them about the writer we're studying and that's it." She was quoting a colleague. Then she says, "Well, I went to school at a small liberal arts school, and part of the strength of that school to me was the fact that the faculty were involved with students, and they didn't just go in and teach topic X. They were also on campus in the evenings, and they were very much involved in the school as a whole. I know they felt overworked, but it was important to them as faculty because that's part of what education is. I wonder if what I'm beginning to hear is, I have to make a decision because I have to do research, I have to do teaching, I have to do my outside life, and I can't cut back on my outside life. These are often people with children and spouses. So it comes down to a choice between research and teaching. What are we here for? Aren't we here to do more for our students than just teach X? I have to do my job very well and to do research, but I also have two young children. I also should be getting another degree, and that means commuting to the city. Also, it's important to me to be involved in the college community, serving on committees, etc. I also happen to be one of those people who needs to sleep at night. One thing that suffers is that I don't have many friends out here because I'm split in so many pieces. I would name that as one whole calling has fallen out of the picture. We speak callings, we're called to be children, parents, friends, teachers, musicians, our various avocations, whatever. Okay, one whole calling falls out of the picture there, friend. I like to have students over to my house for dinner. Do I have to decide I can't do that anymore for a year because I have to write a book because I'm up for tenure soon? Don't we have room at this college for 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 different kinds of people, some of whom are very good scholars and some who would like to work on a project over 5 or 10 years? Do we say you can only get tenure if you can do all those things? Is the college going to tenure superwomen who are going to collapse after a few years, or superwomen who are so burned out that even after sabbatical they just aren't doing some of the things they had been doing, like extracurricular activities, or they're frustrated because they didn't get that book finished during sabbatical, and now they don't have any time with all their other responsibilities? You all know those stories, I think, in the various realms in which you live and work. So something's rotten in Denmark, as Shakespeare said. Maybe I'll cite one other. This was a study that helped to kind of define the situation. But again, in that context, a study of associated colleges of the Midwest. Those are private liberal arts schools in the Midwest, all pretty good schools, that looked at, polled faculty between 79 and 84 about why they left. These were faculty that left the institution. And here is percentage of non-retired former faculty rating family and career conflicts as important in the decision to leave. Well, these are the kinds of conflicts, comparing the percentage of women that rated these as important as opposed to men. And this is where I think we again see that these are often women's issues. Spouse employment not available at the college's location. 32% of the women said that. 12% of the men said that. Other family needs not met in the college's location. About even, 8-9% men and women. Child care facilities inadequate. 7% of the women said that. 2% of the men. Excessive family responsibilities limited scholarly work. 14% of the women, only 1% of the men. And excessive college responsibilities limited family time. 23% of the women said that, only 8% of the men. But almost all of them, the women were much higher in ranking these as issues that led to them deciding to leave that school. So we could talk about, and before we just talk about briefly some of the policies that I looked at in these schools. I want to sort of interject another kind of issue. I'm wanting to look at this in a kind of public shared way, that there are some things that we share. But others would say that the issues are all very personal. And those are the folks that are doing the work looking at addictions and our own sort of dysfunctions, and that basically saying that these are real personal issues that we've got to sort out. There's a reason that this is happening. And I'll just share with you some of my notes from that session on why am I working myself to death that Diane Fassel did with some of the women clergy in Anaheim. And she talked about addiction to work, and you've maybe read some of those things. And it's the most, they'd say, addiction to work. And now, I'm sort of contradicting myself in even sharing any of this, because I'm saying I don't think this is the crucial issue at one level for us. She says that addiction to work is the most integrated into our society of all our addictions. Support throughout our society for that. It's probably the only addiction. Work and jogging, she said, are the only two addictions that we brag about. Other addicts don't boast about their addictions. The work week is getting longer generally. 42.5 hours is the average work week for workers. Any of you in various kinds of professions know that people just proudly define that a professional work week is 50 or 60 hours. And I certainly hear that in parishes. And how in the world can you think that 40 hours is reasonable? There's a myth that workaholics are always working. They are, but maybe they don't always look like it. They might be in a movie, but they're really preparing an agenda for the next meeting. She says that work is the addiction of choice of the unworthy. Because if you keep busy, you won't have to ask why you don't feel good. It also takes care of intimacy fears. Work provides ways to relate to people. And there's that sense of, as soon as my desk gets organized, I'll have a chance to turn and look at myself. Work addiction often has a backup addiction. Money or caffeine or relationship addiction, she spoke of. Workaholics are good at protecting their body and health, because that's the only way they're going to be able to keep it up. So they're out there jogging and going to the health club. But they're finding that workaholics are generally dying of either coronaries or brain hemorrhages. And in some, I think it was in Japan, they're seeing lawsuits against the environment that produced this collapse, the company or the overworking. And work has both a chemical and is both a chemical and a process addiction. She had laid out addictions as coming in two categories: the substance or the process kinds of addictions. Work is both, because you get kind of addicted to the adrenaline production that happens in some of this, and you get that rush from that adrenaline, so it takes the edge off of your pain. And boy, I don't know if you can relate, but the kind of meeting that deadline at the last minute, it's really exciting. Kind of painful in the midst of it, but boy, it's really a victory. I mean, you know it's a victory rather than getting it done. Okay, so we're juggling all these callings and not very well. And I'd say that sort of a kind of secular approach to kind of analyzing if it's working, where it's almost a cost-benefit analysis, can work, I think, in this situation when we look at what are the benefits that accrue to our neighbor. Is another, instead of a secular way of speaking of, are we getting the neighbor loved, in Luther's language? Are we being effective are those benefits accruing to our neighbor as we seek to love them? You know, the kids are going wild because the parents aren't loving them very well. They're never home, and things aren't going very well at the workplace because you kind of feel like you should be at home. And I think that kind of analysis we've already used to reassess some of our other callings. For example, people who have thought about, is the neighbor getting love very well when they are working at a place that makes nuclear bombs? I think that has been one way in which people have rethought that. Or when they participate in investing in South African business. The question of, is that getting the neighbor loved very well? So we'd have to ask, what kind of life is the church modeling? How can we model something different? And certainly in those educational institutions, the places where we want to say to younger adults, these are the kinds of lives we invite you into. What are we modeling at that point? Are we modeling a life with many callings? Or maybe just one? Well, let me just mention some of the kinds of policies that can be helpful, and then I want us to talk, because I think you all have thought about this perhaps longer than I have. There are some organizations that are dealing with some of these issues more and more at the level of work, maybe not the level of all our callings, but an organization called New Ways to Work. It's in San Francisco. It professes to be the oldest and community-based work resource centers in the country, looking at a variety of things from the length of the work week and other things. There's an Association of Part-Time Professionals that started in 1978. A group called Catalyst, headquartered in New York, that works with corporations and individuals to develop career and family options. One thing I think is pretty interesting, Mondale, when he was vice president, suggested a family impact statement that would be attached to governmental legislation that would have to look at around job policies or whatever, what's the impact on the family. And I would suggest that we could maybe think of some of this as looking at a multiple callings impact statement. When we consider various policies or changes or paths, what's the impact on our many callings? I think that some of the innovative work policies really do have an impact on some of what we're talking about. Supporting people in their many callings at the kind of corporate, communal, systemic, policy level. So, personal leaves, sabbaticals, parental leaves, added vacation time, on work, site, daycare, flexible benefit plans, flex time, job sharing, permanent part-time work or career viable part-time work, and relocation policies that work with the needs of both spouses. Lutheran colleges were sort of mixed. I polled academic deans at Lutheran colleges across the country, and here and there, sort of innovative policies stood out, but they were just here or there. Colleges that did work with industry in the area to try to help spouses find work. One school has a situation where two spouses share one full-time teaching position, but that's sort of hit and miss. You know, they just happen to be in the same department or the same discipline. One does have on the books a process for part-time teaching leading to tenure, because it takes forever. Yeah. Hardly any of them have daycare on campus, and usually insurance is cited as a reason But I think, like the ELCA headquarters now has daycare on campus, on site. And I did not look into the details of the insurance complaint. So. Some careers already have built into them some flexible work hours, and faculty certainly tended to have that advantage. Another possibility is taking turns working, spouses doing that. And not many careers allow for that dropping in and out very much. One interesting thing I learned about was the cluster of five schools in central Massachusetts, Amherst, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, Smith, and University of Massachusetts Amherst. They've worked out an associate's program whereby the spouse of a faculty member at any of these schools may apply for a room of their own for 1 year, sometimes renewable, office space and no salary, where they can work on pursuing their own career needs, whether it be writing grant proposals, doing research, or whatever. That is a pretty neat way of supporting those needs. And that space can also be applied for by faculty who've been denied tenure and need some time to figure out what's next. Or as people move into other careers from teaching. Now, we aren't all involved in institutions like that. Lutheran institutions that are somewhat large and work off of sort of Lutheran underpinnings. So one of the questions I'd like some help on is, how can we model, as members of the church, how can we model for the wider culture, or be kind of a mentoring community of imagination for the culture, how we can live out our many callings? I think very often in the church we've sort of looked down the street and waited to see what corporations are doing. And then maybe we would learn in our church institutions how we might do things. But I think in terms of our theological understandings, we have reason to be leading the way. And how might that impact things like our parish life, for example? And I'm certainly anxious to try some of these things out. Harvey Cox is the one who said that the Christian, and I'm sorry for the imagery here, it's a little too militaristic for me, but Christians, or the church, is the only army that gets reinforced for staying in the barracks. I think we keep people so busy coming to church that we disable them for their life in the world, for the very variety of callings that we say we want to empower them for. We want to get out in the world, and that's where our ministry is. Well, but I don't have time. I have to go to choir on Wednesday and get the kids there for Thursday confirmation, and then we've got this committee meeting that goes for 3 hours on Monday nights, and you know, I mean, we basically pull the family apart, as well as keep people having no time for that ministry that we say is why we're going to church, so we can get equipped to do that stuff out there. So some churches have experimented with trying to do everything in one night. You know, you come, you have worship service, you maybe have supper, the kids go here, you go there, you know, kind of get it all done in one night. Churches I've heard that have done that, it's been a process of many years and many fights. You can imagine the first thing I would feel like is, oh, the pastor's just lazy. She's trying to arrange things so she's free the rest of the nights of the week. You know, very self-serving. We're sure that's why she's proposing this. I'm making up for years of heat in my example. Yeah.
I think there's a lot of insidious work pressure in the church that in many ways even goes beyond the corporate world that you inferred or talked about, that somehow being servants for the church as a whole, and perhaps for even the parishioners, but I'm thinking mostly of professional staff, has meant that the harder you work, the better pastor, for example, you are, or And people have kind of gotten a mindset that if it's daytime, you ought to be in the office. And I'm not a clergyman, but even in the human service field, if you're golfing on a Wednesday afternoon, that must mean you only work 35 hours. Because, of course, no one really works at night or weekends. Mm-hmm. And clergy are really vulnerable to that, I think. And they self-destruct because of their own addiction, perhaps, as you mentioned. But the clergy people that I know are reacting a tremendous amount to the congregational pressure that says just what I'm saying, that while it may be true you have an occasional night call, we may not know it, that may be seven straight nights, but you hear of the one night, and they have meetings every night, etc. But to be gone on a Tuesday morning, even to do private study, seems not acceptable. I've heard many, many clergy complain about their own time use, using those kinds of illustrations, and so pretty soon they become a work machine, and I think that's symptomatic of the church as a whole, that we, as for many of us who aren't clergy, have that same thing, that if we are not busy, if we are not criticizing ourselves, other people are. So we're very, and that goes for some, I think that almost goes beyond the corporate expectation of the 60 hour versus the 40. We may be talking 65 or 70 hours.
Sure. I worked with a pastor once.
You go to the National Church office and all you look at is beleaguered, fatigued people because of the tremendous press they put on themselves to deliver for the church. I think that's.
Yeah. Or what do we model when we come to a church council meeting and brag that, you know, we worked 75 hours that week? What does that model? And I'm not saying that it's only the pastor who models good or bad, but I'm real interested in how all of us as members of the church can lead the way in making these issues public issues. Now, maybe the church should be devoting a lot of its time to advocacy in workplaces and for legislation that would work for more sane work policies. Maybe that would be a very appropriate arena for us to work in helping people live out their many callings. That it would be exactly to the point and to the issue of how are we going to get the neighbor love? Now people would say, you know, why is this church spending all their time working for some kind of legislation? You know, what does that have to do with the church? But I would think that perhaps that has a lot to do with what we say we're about. What are the thoughts and comments you have?
It seems like some personalities can learn to control being workaholics and so forth. But when you've got a situation like you were reading about on that college campus, that is really a catch-22, isn't it, for those people mm-hmm. who have to produce, who have to be there for the kids, who have to teach, you know, that mm-hmm. that sounds like a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. How many of you feel like your lives are pretty frenetic? What are the rest of you doing here? What attracted you to this session? It's those other people down the street?
Yeah.
I wanted to know the motivations of the workaholics so I can live with them.
So it's perceived that the issue is working. It's that calling that we give too much of our time and energy to. It's not those parentaholics. It's not those communityaholics. It's that we put too much energy into work, or is it that we care about too many things? Well, we're trying to work. We're trying to love our kids. We're trying to keep in touch with our spouse. Maybe, you know, we set up our little hour meeting a week, and how are you doing? Can I get on your schedule this week? You know, but or is the issue work mostly?
Too many roles.
Too many roles.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that different now than before?
Divorce.
Give it a break.
I mean, too many more opportunities. I think I just want to be involved in everything. Mm-hmm. A lot of people do. Mm-hmm.
We're getting a dissenting opinion here.
Too many roles. Too many roles. I'm a teacher, I'm a single parent, I'm doing all of it. Like, mm-hmm. I'm trying to be a member of the church, and I don't ever see close friends. My friends see me in the summer. Mm-hmm. And there's a clown that came to school. He was so much fun, he was a juggler. And he picked up these scarves, you know? And he started juggling three. He was beautiful in four, and he was beautiful in five, and six, and seven. And he looked like a total ass, and he just started crying. Mm-hmm. Too many roles. Mm-hmm. Too many things to do. Just to do the things you need to do. And people say, well, you've got to take time for yourself. Really? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we preach that as if it's good news. We even hear it from the pulpit. And the good news for today is you've got to take time for yourself. Oh, I don't hear that as good news. Oh, one more thing I've got to do.
It's always likely to drop, you know?
And one more thing
I'm
not
to do. I have 15 scores for my fifth graders. Yeah. Shall I drop those?
And one more thing I'm not doing well. One more thing to feel bad about. Yeah. And we say, yeah. Good news. Yeah. That's the good news for today.
How do we change society? Because society has changed. It could be years ago you were a good farmer as the male and you were a good housewife and you had a lovely family and you all went to church on Sunday and there weren't, you didn't run the kids to baseball, you didn't run them to soccer, you didn't, and, you know, or you didn't run to Holden in the summer. You all had your small jobs, you did that well, and you were happy in doing that well. Or we're enriched by that. But as society has changed, you've had so many more opportunities to do things. You hear about more. You want more. You wanted to have that house when you were 25 instead of when you were 40. You wanted to do all the things. We have this natural society change just going faster and faster. How do you slow it down? Without tearing apart some of the society around you, because some of the things you talk about changing the church or changing education, when you go to some of those things or want to put all those meetings on one night or start a daycare because that's your ministry, that'll tear apart some of the church around you. And is that serving or following?
It'll tear apart the church.
Well, tears apart relationships or how one person views having a daycare versus you viewing having a daycare.
So to keep the peace, we don't change anything.
That's what happens.
No, what he's talking about is in our particular church, we have a nursery school, and we have a very small building that's using up quite a bit of the space, and there's a faction in the church that's saying, that room isn't available for meetings anymore, and I can't get into it, and I can't, you know, all this space is being used just for these little kids, and we should have a youth room, and we shouldn't be using a room this way, we should be using it this way instead, and...
It disrupts the society. The same thing, if you changed how you did your job at work, and changed the rules, it's going to change the work group that you're in, too, if those rules are changed. So, like you say, you don't change them because you keep peace. And just keep it rolling.
Yeah, that's one of the obstacles in a larger institution, like a church, that if you make a big change, then there's any dissension.
And I think this is one of the places where we get in touch with how enculturated the church is. For us to do something very different from the culture. The culture says, program more, do more, be busy, and those are signs of life and success. And if we as the church, within the culture, say, no, we think life is to program less, to do things in different ways, to go, you know, a successful youth program, you're doing lots of things, right? What if it meant something else? You know, and for that to be understood as faithfulness.
Reaching outreach, including the community in the church. Mm-hmm. I see these daycares under that.
But the dilemma comes, what does it mean for the church to act on different values than the culture, than the society has?
When you talk about like the church maybe slowing down its program, maybe not saying that it should have more program or more activities within its program, but people will just fill it up with something else. I mean, I see that all the time.
Right, those are the powers and principalities we have to fight.
Like everybody has to be doing something. It's like to sit down for an evening, you feel guilty if you sit down for a full evening.
Is that something? So how can we support each other in that?
Don't tell me.
I just do it.
Don't tell the neighbors.
Somebody else doesn't like the idea that I sit for an evening. Tough luck on that person.
All right, there's a pretty radical view.
Just don't tell the neighbors.
Close the drapes. Do you have someone up here to come?
I'm just really tired of the, I guess, legalistic way that we approach a lot of the stuff in the churches, you know, kind of the have-to of ministry, you know, where there's an intensity and you're always pushing yourself, push, 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 yet there's no real passion. To move from that intensity to passion, you know, born with the inside, a real desire and a real want, rather than expectations all around you and meeting those expectations and performing for the church in a way. Because that, I think, brings a lot of sterility to the ministry, leads to burnout. I'm burned out after a year of ministering in one area where it was just too much have to and not a real passion, what the real calling is. I think the passion is what keeps it going and gives you that fulfillment and takes away the have to part of it and the frenetic part of it. But it seems to be getting more and more common in a lot of the churches, you know, the ones that are not mainline, you know, these new non-denominational churches, the large ones, you know, where they got all their program just down to the T and there's all this performance orientation, and it gets to be very stifling. You know, the church has it all together, church is growing, yet, like you say, there's no real ministry. There's no they got all their outreach programs, send with mothers and whatever, but is it really doing anything?
And how to find the balance between some of those very important things that churches do and means they meet an important ministry that goes on, but what does that mean in the individual lives of people in terms of when their ministry isn't taking place in the church or as a part of the church? All the other ministries are callings that we are a part of.
I grew up with lots of, we have to do this expectation. We're expected to do this, we're expected to do that, because it looks the way it's supposed to. Somebody says we're supposed to church and do things, because we're expected to do this, and we get tied up in all the expectations for ourselves and our the way the church looks and the way everything. We don't pay so much attention to what's expected and we want to do them.
So, sometimes I think it's more important to be a friend to your recently divorced neighbor than to start a group for. But yet, there's always that guilt, oh, we should have a group for this, we should have a group for that. But if we do that, then are we kind of saying, well, they're in a group now, so they're okay. And to be a friend takes more of a personal commitment and possibly a lot more time, but I think maybe it's more beneficial to both.
Yeah, along that lines, I've been involved in deaf ministry at our church, and it's been 2 years of just no real meaningful relationships developed, and you know the program is there, and you know there's like 5 or 6 deaf, and you know we got them plugged in or whatever, but is it really affecting their lives? And I've just felt this urge to really go down to the streets of Seattle and just hang out in the bars and talk to people. And but there's something inside me that doesn't want to make that investment, that doesn't want to sacrifice in that way. And it's easy to want to be absorbed in that structure, you know, where there's a name to it. You're in the deaf ministry. Mm-hmm.
There.
Well, when you talked about you referred to our calling, maybe that's part of, we don't really know what our callings are, and so we're dabbling in dressing ourselves amongst thousands of things when it's really only 3 things that we should really be called to, at least at that point in our life, and maybe 10 years from now a different calling will come. But I think we do a lot of dabbling, and then we don't really do real well at any of those things because we're so stressed out and spread so thin amongst those things. We tend to want to do it all. Mm-hmm. And we do that to our kids, too. We want our kids to be in everything and anything. And, you know, we start them at preschool, setting a pattern of do this, do this, do this, sign up now, and, you know, get in there, and, or you won't be able to be an excellent swimmer by age 10, you know. We start them out real young, training them to
be busy,
try everything and be busy.
I agree a lot with that, and I think Ron said something earlier that fit for me a lot. But it, perhaps part of the reason we're not changing very swiftly, in spite of all the evidence and the complaints, is that we really aren't centered on making radical changes ourselves, and collectively we become the expression of the church and society. So, to just use one of what I heard as illustrations was, if it's really true that we want for ourselves at 25, which we could have gradually earned by 50, we have set ourselves up, and our neighbors are maybe the same way, to achieve that, and that automatically centers us on economics, let's say. If we want our kids all to somehow be a fantasized version of Captain Marvel, then we dare not have them not assigned to every educational and avocational pursuit they can find as soon as they're old enough to be potty trained, or even before. So we maybe don't really want to make the changes ourselves, and then we get to be kind of resentful of those who suggest we should. So. And that's the part of Ron's comment I was hearing, in that we really end up protecting the status quo. It benefits our view of where we're going, and we don't want people to trouble with that. You know, I think we need to be a little more critical. I need to be a little more critical of how I am viewing others if I am not centering myself.
Mm-hmm. A lot of it is a game we play, isn't it? I think about some fellow teachers who are at school night and day, and with a couple like, I don't know, who else would I talk about? Oh, come on. You know, if you want to be that way, if you really enjoy it that much, then admit it and say, this is where I really like to be. I like to be working constantly.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, it's just a game. It's saying one thing and doing another and pretending.
Betsy, you started to say something before.
Can't remember what it is.
Okay.
I think one of the frustrations in our church anyway is that it's the same people doing everything. And you sometimes think, I am not going to volunteer for one more thing. This is the year I'm not going to teach Sunday school. I'm going to sit back and let them find them from somebody else. And so you wait, and the clarion call goes out, and you know, we only need 20 more, and now we need 15, and now we need 10. And there they are, the day before Sunday school starts, and you think, oh, geez, I suppose I'll volunteer again. And I don't know, I just see that the same people in the church are always the workhorses. And there are lots of people who belong to the church but maybe don't participate very much in the church, and I think that's the way it's always been, and I don't know how to get around it, but I think that things would be a lot healthier if there was some way to get people more willing to participate or helpful, because then the people who are the workhorses wouldn't burn out so much and get so fed up.
Yeah, and the church enables their continued frenetic lives, maybe,
right,
by even daring to ask them.
Right.
Yeah.
Please, won't you be the Sunday school teacher?
Well, I'm a teacher, and I've been trying to, like, manage the work there. I really enjoy my work, but I've talked to another friend of mine, and we've been making choices and cutting down on the paperwork. I have a friend who grades every single paper every student does, and I finally came to the realization that you don't have to do all of that. You can take one set, and that's representative of what they're doing. And the students seem to value more the interaction and getting to know them and talking to them, and they get more value out of that than a paper they look at all the red scribbling and throw it away that you've spent, you know, 30 minutes on. And it really works. You have to start picking and choosing, where can I cut down? How can I consolidate. And I'm constantly trying to do that so that I have more time than when I go home, so I have some home life, and it's really made a big difference. But I've done what some of the others have done, that I free up some time and I fill it in with something else. So I've cut that out.
I'm sitting here thinking about the comment someone made that you've got to take time for yourself. I have to. At 5 o'clock every morning, I'm a teacher and I'm in school by 7 o'clock. But 5:30, I'm up and I'm at my desk, and I've got to take that half an hour as we read it or say in the Lord's Prayer, give us this day, not give us our daily bread or give us our bread for the week. Sunday morning, but give us this day our daily bread. God in his wisdom gives us enough grace to get through one day. And if we allow ourselves to just sit and reflect on one little verse that always seems to come up, any situations that arise during the day, there seems to be an answer. There's that little bit of grace that is going to get you through that situation. And we just find ourselves running in all directions. And I pulled out of the church, not totally out of, but total involvement, and decided I've got to look and find, where do I fit in this church? And then do my best job there. And I really firmly believe we've got to take that time to get that little bit of grace to get through each day, and then recognize all the little things that happen during the day. As that is God's grace. I paint in the winter or in the summertime, paint houses. I just love it because that's when I think. I don't have to think about what I'm doing. I mean, it's the same thing all the time, but that's when you think. But all of a sudden, there's little incidences of God's grace. For example, being up on a 40-foot ladder and having the wasp coming at you and being able to get them all with one stroke of the brush. Now, that's God's grace. But if you don't recognize it as such, all the little things in life go right on by you and you don't even realize it. That's the grace of God getting you through those situations. But you got to think about it every day, I think.
I would like to address the lady's statement that the same people do everything, do most of the duties, the jobs in the church, and I agree with that. But I have experienced that there's usually kind of a small group, shy people, want to help, but they never get asked. And they're too shy to come forward and volunteer. So there probably are some more resources out there that don't get used.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's really important that people be asked and you know, involved in small ways without overwhelming them. And, you know, even if you get some no's, this is trying to involve others. But I think the churches are going to have to look at different ways of putting together programs, because what worked at one time with women's groups when women weren't all in the workforce no longer exists. And so a lot of the jobs, a lot of the structure of the church is, you know, no wonder it gets overwhelmed, because you don't have the people that can do that anymore. And so, you know, I really feel that the churches are undergoing, you know, some really big changes.
But that's also, I think that's very valuable for me, in that it's forcing me not only to look at the church or to women and their role in whole society, but the whole people on earth. All the different races of people and all the different values that people have. You know, I was raised in a very strict Norwegian background, you know, that you had your place and you stayed in your place, and women have no place in the workforce, and those people on the other side of the tracks, you don't even look at those, you don't date those people because they're Catholic and you're Lutheran. The whole route. But I've really had to struggle with all of this. And to really force yourself to open up the mind that, you know, we are all people of God, and we're all people of this earth with a lot of different talents and a lot of different opinions that you have to respect.
I think we've also that issue of separate spheres, work and home, kind of the public and the private spheres, were kept separate for so many years, and I think that's one of the reasons that we don't see many policies that kind of address the intermingling of the two either. Mm-hmm. It would come up with some creative work policies, but what does it mean when all that comes together? We're balancing that.
We've mentioned, of course, I suppose probably because we are focusing more on the church, but talking about the same crux of people probably doing the same thing, but I think that's just that's the way it is in any organization or any workforce. You're going to, I mean, that's just the way the world is. I think it's just that we think because you belong to a church, you should be willing to help out. And it's the unique attitude that we have towards the church, that everybody that's going to belong to a church is going to be helpful. While in a workforce, you've got people who are going to pitch in that much more than the person that's over here that's just going to sit at his desk and do an 8-5. Teachers, my husband was a teacher for a while. He put in longer days than some of the other people, but you don't have the same kind of attitude there that you do for the church. You know, and I don't know if that's the church's fault, or if it's the church organization type fault, or if it's just our, you know, we as part of the church, we all figure that anybody who belongs to a church is going to be supposed to be in there pitching in.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's a danger for someone like me who's concerned about us not keeping people disabled for the rest of their callings, a tendency to maybe not want to ask them to do something at church. But I think your comment is real well taken about there's a faculty couple here who they moved to north of Minnesota, and you know, there's kind of three ELCA churches in town. You know, it's not a very big town, you kind of know what each other's doing. And they joined one church, and that was pretty interesting to see which one they'd picked, you know. And now after a year, they switched to the other one. And I said, well, why did you do that? That's really a big coup, you know. The other one got, you know. And, well, they said, we'd been at this other church for a whole year, and they never asked us to do one single thing. And this is a, you know, dual career couple. It's very busy. But to remember that... the flip side, mm-hmm. that we don't only err on the side of sucking people into the church and away from the rest of their life, but mm-hmm. on the other side too.
Well, I guess I can't, along those same lines, those of us who are used to doing a lot and see ourselves as a, and there's some element of control in that kind of behavior. I think for a lot of us it takes some effort to be patient with the moving of the Spirit in the church, or I do a lot of work on not-for-profit boards and so on, that the silent folk, the strangers amongst us, there are ways to encourage rather than to persuade, and there are ways to resist our own urges that either come out of power or guilt, that we really ought to do this. If we would spend time helping other people learn the joy, we would have to do less ourselves. I mean, I got to remind myself of this all the time. Well, if nobody else will do it, I'll do it. And when I don't do it, and especially if I take time to invite someone else to do it, I find out they do as good, or heaven forbid, even a better job than I did. So I think us, you know, I think there's a lot in the I would kind of wince when you say the church, or I thought I heard you say once, the church, part of the good news is the invitation to serve, and if we're there are lots of ways to do that, and persuasion and guilt trip may not be the way, but the invitation needs to be there, mm-hmm, I think.
I want to, as we're running out of time here, leave you with two thoughts, and one is, how can we as the church buck some of the values of the culture and do things in a different way? As you said, things are different now. What does that mean about our particular ministry as a congregation? How can we empower people for all their callings, not just, how can we do our programs in a different way? But what does it mean to empower people for their life out there, if we genuinely believe that in all those callings we get the neighbor love, that all of those things are important, all those roles to which we're called. And then also, how can we as the church model some new things for the rest of the culture? And how can we be involved in the public sharing of these dilemmas, whether it be at the point of advocating for various kinds of legislation and doing that as a church or as a body of Christians, or holding out some models to the wider culture for ways to seriously be faithful to our many callings, and to move the questions beyond questions of why do I work so hard in my job to all of our callings, and how can I move beyond the question of, well, let's see, I do it this way, I've got this great daycare place, so that's the thing that helps my life hold together. It's my kind of private solution, to ways that we can connect with each other around some common issues and supporting each other for life in the world, in our many callings. I don't have a lot of answers toward that, but I think it's crucial for us to take seriously within the church the questions that are surrounding us in the culture and in our lives. The culture knows the problem and is capitalizing on it by writing about it. And what are we, how are we going to respond? So thanks for your comments.